Grace, chapter 6. Ye shall do my judgments. The conduct befitting the covenant people. Precept, implicit and explicit. Thus far we have been engrossed with the symbolism of the law, and indeed must continue to be so preoccupied to the very end of our study, the law being what it is. We must not, however, overlook the fact that the law spoke not only enigmatically but also plainly. To preserve a proper balance, it is therefore advisable, before we plunge yet more deeply into the study of the symbolism, to pause for a while and review some of the clear moral teaching which it enjoined upon Israel. As we have seen, in every conceivable way, the symbolism of the law bade Israel act in all things according to the rule, holiness to the Lord. What then did holiness connote, seeing that it was so vital that Israel should pursue it? The law gave a clear answer. It defined by a variety of moral precepts what manner of persons they were meant to be as Yahweh's covenant people. It is some of these precepts which we shall now proceed to examine, but while we consider them, we shall find it profitable to retain the subject of symbolism in our minds and to relate many of the precepts to the peculiar circumstances attending their delivery. The Ten Commandments were unique. They were both uttered aloud and put into literary form by God himself, acting through his angelic representative. To the accompaniment of sight and sound so frightful that even Moses quaked with fear, they were addressed directly to the people with a terrifying audibleness. Ye came near and stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the midst of heaven, with darkness, clouds, and thick darkness, and the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. Ye heard the voice of the words. The events of that day were meant to be a byword to all succeeding generations, and a memory so awesome to those who witnessed them that their very terribleness would prevail on them to be obedient. Here, in ten simple statutes, was the quintessence of God's claims upon them. In entering into covenant with him, they undertook to give their full and ready obedience to them. Without that undertaking, God could not accept them. When they had duly become his people, he, with his own finger, inscribed them on two tables of stone to serve as an enduring reminder of their moral duty. In consequence, the tables of stone came to be known as the Covenant, and the Ark, in which they were duly placed, as the Ark of the Covenant. Above them, as they reposed in the most holy place, God manifested himself, thereby declaring himself to be essentially a moral being, making moral claims upon all who would seek to commune with him. I am the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And this was the simple and all-sufficient preamble to the whole of the Ten Commandments. What a world of meaning was compressed into the brief compass of that simple affirmation. The one who spoke was he who had proved himself Lord of the entire earth in the very process, ironically enough, of proving himself the Saviour of Israel in particular. How tellingly the connection was thus shown between the redemption of Israel and its duty. God, who addressed them, had demonstrated himself to be the supreme arbiter of human destiny, the one eternal God. So none dare deny him the obedience he desired. 1. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. How appropriate and how inevitable was this first commandment in view of the preamble. To acknowledge any other god as real, whether by actual avowal or simply by their mode of life, would be to deny the whole meaning of their redemption and make mockery of the covenant. Hath God essayed to go and take him a nation from the midst of another nation, by temptations, by signs and by wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by a stretched out arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? The answer to Moses' question was clearly no. Why then had God done it? Unto thee it was showed, that thou mightest know that the Lord, he is God, there is none else beside him. God is one. That was the burden of the first commandment. Its implications were tremendous. Since he is one, none other exists. Therefore none other can contend with him for loyalty. And all who do so merely declare themselves thereby to be no gods. With that rejoinder, Christ, when sorely tried, exposed the devilishness of the devil and withstood his guile. Hear, O Israel, was Moses' appeal to the nation. The Lord our God is one Lord. For Moses, this was much more than a mere profession of faith. It was also an emphatic statement of Israel's moral duty. He saw in God's oneness an imperative claim upon man for oneness of service, for undivided loyalty, for total, unreserved devotion, which leaves no part of the complex nature of man unenlisted. So he added, as a significant commentary, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. Such was to be the conception of worship that was to dominate the thinking of the covenant people and induce them to be obedient in all things. That alone would save them from trying to serve two masters or to receive honour one of another, rather than seek the honour which comes from the only God. That conception of worship essentially entailed a conception of God which was wholly spiritual. Know therefore this day, and consider it in thine heart, that the Lord, he is God in heaven above and upon the earth beneath. There is none else. God, that is everywhere present, for he is spirit. His authority is therefore absolute, and brooks no gainsaying by wayward man. Thou shalt keep therefore his statutes and his commandments, which I command thee this day, that it may go well with thee and with thy children after thee, and that thou mayest prolong thy days upon the earth, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for ever. Israel were to realize that deliverance from Egypt had not been a pointless act, but one with a moral purpose, namely that they should reflect God's holiness in their way of life. If they failed to conform to that purpose, their survival would be in jeopardy. As with Egypt, so with Israel. As they treated God, so he would treat them. 2. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Tellingly, the preamble to the commandments as a whole, together with the very first of the ten, put everything into correct perspective. The second was designed to ensure that Israel's conception of Yahweh should remain purely spiritual. and not degenerate into the worship of Him, the invisible, through the medium of some visible material symbol. The people's desire for one to intervene between them and God received God's approval as a becoming confession of unworthiness on their part. Moses was at once appointed to be their go-between. Each time God wished thenceforward to speak with them. But whereas a man was on this unique occasion allowed to act as go-between when God chose to speak to man, it was made emphatically clear that no man-made device would in turn be tolerated as a medium of communication when man chose to offer worship to God. If the nation chose to renounce its privilege of hearing God speak to it directly, God certainly had no intention of renouncing his own right to receive worship on his terms alone. While therefore the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was, the first thing that God instructed Moses to do was to remind the people that they had seen no visible representation of himself during the brief period when the Ten Commandments sounded forth, and that therefore no attempt should be made to reproduce it or to symbolize it in any way as an aid to the worship of him. The Lord said unto Moses, "Thus thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, ye have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. Ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall ye make unto you gods of gold." Moses carried out this instruction most faithfully. The Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. Ye heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude, only ye heard a voice. Take ye therefore good heed unto yourselves, for ye saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spake unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest ye corrupt yourselves and make you a graven image. Take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make you a graven image, or the likeness of anything which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee. Once for all, God would have it known at the very outset of Israel's national life how great a fallacy it was to imagine that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. He would remind them that God is not the creation of man, but man the creation of God. On the basis of the recognition of that fact alone, would God accept man's worship? And it was in brazen defiance of it that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, made Israel to sin. Not even the worship of the heavenly bodies offered specifically in recognition that it was he that made and moved them all would be acceptable to him. One representation only would he allow of himself, one that was necessary for the solemn ritual of the covenant ratification, or other ceremonial occasions such as that when the law was engraved on stones on Mount Ebal. This unique object was to be an altar. But even then it was emphatically to be only an adjunct of worship, and in no sense an object of worship. Thou shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thine oxen. And to stress once again with the utmost emphasis that even such a representation of himself should not be graven in any way by art or man's device. It was specified, "An altar of earth thou shalt make unto me, and if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone. For if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. That is, its constituent parts were to be God-made, not man-made. Finally, and even more emphatically, neither shalt thou go up by steps unto mine altar, that thy nakedness be not discovered thereon. Those organs which enable man to procreate might be regarded as endowing him with the same creative power as God himself, a notion akin to the perverted one which formed the basis of the revolting fertility cults of those and later days. Such cults were abhorrent to the Creator, and no altar of his was to be, even in the most incidental way, profaned by those who ministered at it, as were the altars at which pagan priesthoods ministered, often in the nude, to the fiendish gods of their own devising. God thus desired both the exclusive worship of his people and the offering of it in the spiritual way appointed. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, jealous not from pique or petty vindictiveness, as in the case of man, but only in vindication of his absolute holiness. Hatred of him is hatred of his holiness, since he is holy. Out of consistency, he must meet the challenge, which he does by visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Jesus himself warned the false teachers of his day of the inexorable character of this law. But love of him calls forth in turn his transcendent mercy and willingness to forgive, for he is gracious. 3. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Both the flippant and the deceitful use of the divine name were strictly forbidden. The flippant use was a token of gross and perilous disrespect. The deceitful use brought him, the faithful and true God, as the Exodus had proved him to be, into association with falsehood, and so profaned his name. In such a case, a sin offering was necessary to cleanse the offender of his guilt, with all that that entailed by way of publicity. As for the downright blasphemer, he had to die the death. Thus was reverence for God's name ensured. 4. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. The Sabbath was a sign between God and Israel and closely related to the name. It commemorated the rest from Egyptian bondage already achieved, as they were reminded in the preamble. It was an earnest of the rest to which God was leading them, a means of commemorating that rest once Joshua had won it for them, and finally a pointer forward for the reflective Israelite to the ultimate rest, of which these, like the creative rest of God, were foreshadowings. Rest from sin and its bondage. That was to be the goal of God's people and the object of their longing. The memory of their sufferings in Egypt should therefore quicken their appreciation of God's saving work and be the inspiration of their obedience to the Sabbath law. 5. Honour thy father and thy mother. Obedience to their early superiors was to train them in that submissiveness to their divine Lord, which gave him such great delight. 6. Thou shalt not kill. The sanctity of human life was upheld, and murder outlawed. 7. Thou shalt not commit adultery. The sanctity of marriage was declared absolute. 8. Thou shalt not steal. The rights of property received due sanction. 9. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Honesty and integrity were enjoined upon them. 10. Thou shalt not covet. To kill, commit adultery, and steal was to offend against one's neighbour indeed. To bear false witness was to offend against him in word. To covet what was his was to offend against him in thought, whence words and deeds both spring. Nothing could be more comprehensive or more manifestly make everything contingent upon absolute respect for one's fellow man than this commandment in particular. Suffice it here that we give it, and the five commandments which precede it, but brief mention, since repeatedly as we proceed we shall find them being reinforced by the ritual ordinances which will come under our review, as well as restated in more elaborate form in other legislation. These words the Lord spake unto all your assembly in the mount, out of the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick darkness, with a great voice, and he added no more, and he wrote them in two tables of stone, and delivered them unto me. They all resolved themselves ultimately into two precepts. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. It was these two precepts, together with related supplementary legislation, which were to be the mainspring of Israel's life. Thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Obedience to them was to be Israel's constant preoccupation. Moses, as go-between, was given instructions for the application of these commandments in the day-to-day administration of the people's affairs. The covenant to be ratified was to be essentially a national covenant. The Lord hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt, to be unto him a people of inheritance. God would be one party to the covenant, as the altar would symbolize, and all the tribes would form the other party, as the 12 pillars would symbolize. The covenant had therefore to legislate for their community life, with all its vexatious problems, and give guidance to the newly appointed magistrates and their successors, who were to enforce the Ten Commandments. Moses both recounted these instructions to the people and also recorded them in a book, both for public reading at the ratification service and as a record for later generations. These must next engage our attention. The allusion to their previous bondage came in more subtle form this time. The Book of the Covenant began with an insistence on a Hebrew servant's right to release after 6 years' service. While the laws safeguarding the foreign slave against maltreatment by his master accepted that man's bondage as an understood thing. Accidental manslaughter was recognized as a possibility and provision was made for dealing with it. There was to be no commutation of the capital sentence in the case of murder resulting from a brawl or malice. The smiter or curser of his parents and the kidnapper had each to be punished with death. Indisposition resulting from a brawl had to be compensated for by him who occasioned it. In everything, the rule was that the gravity of the punishment should be proportionate to that of the crime. Yet, justice was never to be rough and ready. All punishment was to be legally enforced by the appointed judges. They alone were to calculate the compensation due for any mischief done by one man to another and give to every transgression and disobedience its just recompense of reward. The value of a lost eye in terms of cash would naturally vary from victim to victim, and so with any other part of the body maimed or lost through another's fault. Only in the case of a servant, presumably Hebrew and foreign alike, was the value fixed. Loss of any member, say eye or tooth, due to the master's cruelty, secured his immediate freedom. The life of man is exceedingly precious. That was the principle which regulation after regulation urged upon the recently liberated slaves, who had themselves been habituated all their lives to cruelty and injustice, and with whom the covenant was to be made. Strict justice was to regulate the dealings of man with man, even over the behaviour of their animals. The property of others was to be treated with absolute respect. Theft was condemned as a hateful thing. Any stolen article, if found in the thief's possession, had as a minimum to be restored double. If the thief had cynically proceeded further in crime and had disposed of the stolen article, punishment was again to be adjusted to the crime. If relatively slight, then it was to be 4 sheep for one. If more serious, then it was to be 5 oxen to one. That is, the further a man went in crime, the greater commensurately was to be his punishment. If he had not the means to make restitution, then he was to be sold to procure it. Negligence and inconsiderateness of any kind were to be penalized according to a legal sentence, the normal restitution being like for like. To seduce an unbetrothed maid, for example, entailed marrying her or paying her father the appointed dowry if he withheld his consent to the marriage. The witch, the pervert, and the apostate had alike to be done to death. The cause of the defenceless and needy was to be faithfully defended and the same compassion shown them as that received by the whole nation from God himself. In all things, his supremacy was to be acknowledged by deference to his name and to the authority of his judges, and also in the payment of first fruits to him. As on the 8th day their sons were circumcised and became his, so from the 8th day forward the firstborn of their animals were to be accounted holy to him. And naturally this ritual sanctification of child and animals to have its proper moral counterpart. And ye shall be holy men unto me. This precept again was reinforced with a ritual ordinance. Neither shall ye eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. Ye shall cast it to the dogs. corrupting flesh was a diet for dogs, not the holy. And so moral corruption was to be eschewed as unbecoming for the covenant people. That principle held good for all the nation, judges and people alike. So regulations followed which were concerned not so much with due penalties for offences done as with the positive moral duty of all to be absolutely just, magnanimous, and faithful to God. As disobedience by the criminal would bring down judicial wrath upon his head, as the Book of the Covenant prescribed, so also would disobedience by the nation as a whole as certainly calls a visitation of divine judgment upon them. And conversely, if obedient, they would be richly blessed, and the covenant would come to fulfillment in the safe and happy tenancy of the promised land, which was meant for them alone. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord, and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord hath said will we do." Thus it was that the covenant came to be ratified on the morrow, when Israel undertook to be God's people, with full knowledge of the manner of life which was demanded of them as a result of their participation in it. The statutes recorded in the Book of the Covenant were supplemented during the course of the wilderness wanderings by many additional regulations designed to cover special contingencies. We have an obvious example of this in the various inheritance laws which were promulgated from time to time. Zelophehad died, leaving 5 daughters but no son to succeed him. The daughters petitioned Moses and Eleazar for possession among the brethren of our father. God approved of their request, and a law was issued regulating this and related cases. Not long afterwards, their petition was followed by another, one presented this time on their behalf by some of the Gileadites, which resulted in the promulgation of the law of territorial inheritance. The one arrangement, like the law of levirate marriage, which in purpose bore a close affinity to it, ensured that a man's name was not done away from Israel, and the other, that the children of Israel may enjoy every man the inheritance of his fathers. Their practical purpose is evident, but so also is their didactic aim. They served to remind each individual Israelite, whatever his circumstances, of the greatness of the honour of being a member of the covenant people, and of the preciousness of his heritage. They gave him a proper sense of values and bade him at all costs prove worthy of his high calling and retain his membership of the nation, being an Israelite indeed. A close reading of the narrative reveals that its seeming disconnectedness is often deceptive, and that a careful plan determines its order in cases where supplementary legislation of this kind appears. Thus, the essential principles of the law of the sin offering are restated in Numbers 15, showing how forgiveness was available to those for whose sin some legitimate extenuating factor might be pleaded. In pointed contrast, the next section makes clear that this same forgiveness could not be extended to others, but the soul that doeth aught presumptuously, whether he be born in the land or a stranger, the same reproacheth the Lord, and that soul shall be cut off from among his people, because he hath despised the word of the Lord, and hath broken his commandment, that soul shall utterly be cut off. His iniquity shall be upon him. When we ponder the reason for this contrast, we find the answer immediately to hand, for we next read of the man who wantonly defied the Sabbath law, and that unashamedly in the sight of all the people by gathering sticks. The order was then given to put him to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones without the camp. All the congregation, we note. The entire nation was to express its disapproval of the man's presumption. Never was this scandal to recur, that a man should treat a commandment of the Most High as though it had no more authority than the order of a mortal man. So it was then significantly that the law was proclaimed, bidding them make fringes in the borders of their garments, and put upon the fringes a riband of blue, and it shall be unto you for a fringe, that ye may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them, and that ye seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which ye used to go a-whoring. There is thus a palpable historical and editorial unity pervading this whole section of the law, and we see clearly that occasionally outstanding incidents called forth supplementary additions to the Book of the Covenant. The divorce laws of Deuteronomy 24 are doubtless of this nature. These probably legalized certain existing practices and put an end to grave abuses, but they again subserved a purpose other than the practical and obvious. A wife who was formally dismissed by her husband could not become his again. Neither could any in Israel become God's once more if they found no favour in his eyes because of uncleanness. See the law regarding jealousy offering. Each sinful generation would have to bear its punishment of rejection, even though the promise to the entire race remained inviolate. In similar fashion, the need arose for the regulation of polygamy and for a statement of the right of the firstborn, just because he was the firstborn, even if he was not the son of the favourite wife. The rule for the father was to be: he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Since God jealously guarded the right of the firstborn, ought not Israel to do likewise? The right was theirs, a double portion, because they were the firstborn nation. It was for them to treasure it to the utmost. If they would not, the right would become a burdensome yoke, as it indeed proved to be, as a consequence of their disobedience. Israel received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins, in blessing and in judgment alike. A double portion was to be theirs. Approach to the confines of the land on the second and decisive occasion at the end of the 40 years' wandering, was an obvious time for a restatement, elaboration, and expansion of the ordinances already given. It was made clear that their enjoyment of the land as their national heritage was contingent upon obedience. Any adoption of the abominable practices of those already living there would lead to the same expulsion from it as their predecessors were about to suffer at their own hands. Defile not yourselves in any of these things, for in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you, and the land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land vomiteth out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations. That the land spew not you out also when ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. One overriding principle was to be their constant guide. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, Ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Integrity should characterize all their doings. Ye shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie one to another. And all guile should be eschewed by them. So should all desire to abuse any influence or authority which they enjoyed in order to cheat their neighbour of his rights. Thou shalt not defraud thy neighbour, neither rob him. The wages of him that is hired shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. To mock or take mean advantage of the misfortune of the unfortunate would be a direct insult to Yahweh as the omniscient God. Thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shalt fear thy God. I am the Lord. Justice was to be administered with absolute impartiality, no favour being shown to either rich or poor. Malicious slander for personal profit and all forms of spite were to be abhorred. All grudges and secret resentments were to be brought into the open and amicably resolved. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbour and not suffer sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. I am the Lord. That term, neighbour, was meant to include even the alien resident in their midst. Love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. In every sphere of action, absolute honesty and probity were demanded of them. Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in metiard, in weight, or in measure. Just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin shall ye have. One good and all-sufficient reason made that imperative. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. Therefore shall ye observe all my statutes and all my judgments and do them. I am the Lord. Israel had vowed at Sinai to conform in this way to the will of God. Moses took the book of the covenant and read it in the audience of the people, and they said, "All that the Lord hath said will we do, and will be obedient." As an express reminder of the solemnity and binding nature of that one oath, a special regulation was issued to govern all oaths. Its effect was to show that a permitted vow shall stand. Once made, it demanded fulfillment. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. The children of Israel had not been like some daughter or wife whose father or husband could disallow the oath immediately it was made, but like a widow or grown man had been in enjoyment of total liberty when their word was pledged at Sinai. So the rule for the individual held good for the nation. When thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it. For the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it will be sin in thee. Israel would find then that their liberty had cost them dear if they neglected to make good their promise so freely made. Their God had been true to his word. Woe betide them if they fell short of his constancy. And thus the veriest breath of apostasy had to be dealt with ruthlessly. The most persuasive attempts to subvert them from loyalty to God were to be dealt with in summary fashion. Yes, even in the case of those nearest and dearest to them. For whosoever loved brother, son, daughter, wife, or friend more than God was not worthy of him. Their king, likewise, if ever there was one, was to be guided solely by the law. He shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God. Kindness, humaneness to both men and animals, chastity, generosity. These were the kind of virtues which befitted God's people. Cursed indeed were those who flouted them. It was as Moses said, "And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee, but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good." Israel therefore had no illusions as to what was meant when God declared, "Ye shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine." And though that divine wish seems to have been utterly frustrated by Israel's past record, yet fulfill itself it will nevertheless. Like all God's purposes, it will yet translate itself into fact. God's word will not return to him void, but accomplish that which he pleases, and prosper in the thing whereto he sent it. When finally the time comes for the deliverer to come out of Zion and turn away ungodliness from Jacob.